Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about Y86-64, which is the assembly language we'll be using for most of the rest of the course. We're going to be implementing a simulated processor in that, and this is a subset of x86-64 that our textbook authors made, which is kind of based on the RISC philosophy. It has several things which are more like that reduced instruction set design paradigm. We talked about how it works. First, we talked about some instructions that were in Y86-64 that you may have not seen before, even though they're in x86-64 too. One of these is the conditional move instruction. So this is basically a combination of a conditional jump and a move. Like a conditional jump, it decides what to do based on the condition codes, based on some comparison that happened before. But rather than doing like a full jump, it just skips or does a move, depending on those condition codes. We also saw this overall philosophy where our textbook authors designed the instruction set so that for every instruction mnemonic, meaning the sort of name you use in assembly for an instruction, there was a single set of, well, single type of operands that would be allowed. So once we saw the name of the instruction, we knew what the types of the operands were. And to accommodate this, one of the things they need to do is they need to say, well, move is a very useful instruction, but it does a lot of different things. So they wanted to have different names for the different types of moves, so when you saw a move, you knew exactly what the operands would be. So they split up move into these four instructions that we saw. IR move Q, RR move Q, RR move Q, and MR move Q to represent move with different operands, which would be sort of considered separate instructions. They also said to have this principle that there's sort of one set of type of operands, that we'd have one way of specifying addresses in memory. And you know, they have lots of options. They decided to use the base plus displacement form as the only thing they would allow. And they also need to say, well, we have arithmetic instructions. What should they do arithmetic on if we're only going to allow one thing? And they said registers. That's going to be our most convenient, probably our most efficient to implement. And similarly, for the jump and call, they need to decide what they're going to allow. And well, our most common use of jump and call is calling or jumping a label, which we remember turned into basically an address constant, you know, through the linker. So our jump and call instruction only take a constant. And having made this decision that there's a single type of operands for every mnemonic, the encoding process was basically you look up the mnemonic you're looking at in a table, which has a row for each of what we called an opcode, where the opcode was going to be the most significant 4 bits of the first byte of the instruction, kind of a category of instructions. And there were a bunch of fill-in-the-blank fields. And for different parts of the instruction, we had typically 4-bit fields to fill in. So for some sets of instructions, we grouped them together into one sort of category of instruction that made one line of our table. So like we grouped all the arithmetic instructions together, and we distinguished them with a 4-byte field. For the conditional jump and move instructions, we grouped them together and distinguished what type of condition it was with a 4-bit field. I said byte before, but I meant 4-bit field. And also, we observed that, oh, well, an unconditional move from register to register is just a special case of a conditional move. And an unconditional jump is just a special case of a conditional jump. So we just encoded them the same way, just with that 4-bit field indicating the condition having a value for always true. Okay, so that was our encoding. Then we started talking about, well, we're going to be designing hardware. What is that going to look like? How are we going to talk about hardware? And one thing we need is we need a way to represent values that we're dealing with on our machine. And I said, well, we're going to put these values on wires. And the sort of wires we're going to deal with will have some voltage on the wire. That voltage will propagate through the wire. And that will represent a Boolean value, high voltage for 1, low voltage for 0, for example. But typically, we're acting on things that aren't just 1-bit values. We want to act on like 64-bit values. So we'll have a bundle of wires. And the shorthand I'm going to use is I'm just going to call a bundle of wires an n-bit wire, as if it's one wire that holds like a 64-bit value, but really we know under the hood it's going to be a group of 64 wires, or some other number. And we saw that our hardware design programming language, we're going to have these wires as sort of pseudo-variables. So they're going to represent these bundles of wires, but they're going to kind of look like variables. I believe that's where we left off last time. We'll continue looking at how these sort of pseudo-variable wires work today. But before I move on to that, questions about things we covered last time? Yes? So the question, why is it faster to sometimes do operations on values in memory instead of putting them into registers? So I think you're referring to our lab problem where we assessed why we used less instructions when we were acting on values in memory than in registers. And that's not the same as faster. And if you did the calculations correctly for that problem, you would have found out it was slower with our assumptions about the speed of memory versus non-memory instructions. So as for why a compiler, why that would happen, if we think of what the instructions look like to do a bunch of operations on a value in memory, like if we want to add one to a value in memory and later like multiply it by 3, we can do that with two instructions. If we want to say, oh, wait, doing that on a value in memory is going to be slow, let's do it with a value in a register. Well, that's going to be extra instructions because we might have to spend some extra instructions, possibly, not necessarily, moving a value that we wouldn't have put in a register into a register and back from a register. And that's where the extra instructions would come from. And the hope is that the compiler would do this because it's probably faster. And whether it's faster or not depends on the details of the microarchitecture, so we'll have more insight into that as the semester goes on. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So we were talking about wires. We mentioned our wire bundles. And we also mentioned doing calculations on values with wires. So we have things composed of gates. And our sort of model for how gates work is we put some wires inputting to the gates with some voltages. And with some delay, their output has a calculation based on those. It could be a sample calculation like AND or XOR. And we'll kind of generalize this to say that we can kind of have hardware that implements sort of any computation. And how we'd actually build this is a topic for a different class, you know, that will have the same sort of interface. We'll put in a bunch of values and wires, and with some delay, they'll output a result. And I believe we finished up on sort of the HGLRS representation of wires. So we can declare wires kind of like a variable. It has a name. It has a width in bits. And we have this assignment operation, which you can think of as a connection to a value. So I'm saying that foo is hardwired to 26. That is what it's connected to. It can only be connected to have one thing as input ever. It can be used in multiple places, but it can only have one thing as input ever. So if we wanted the value to change, we have to connect it to something which changes, not to a constant. So we can't like overwrite this. This is done. And that's what our processor has that wire hardwired to. Yes, your question?
So I was wondering in what context we would use this kind of notation where we create a wire as a variable. Is it like when we're describing a system in hardware?
So the question is, what context would we use it? Is when we're describing a system in hardware? Yeah, so this is something we'll use for describing sort of our processor. So we'll have like a wire representing some intermediate value being used in an instruction, and this should represent like a physical bundle of wires. Like for example, if we have a circuit in our hardware which does an addition, we'll have a wire representing its output.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay, other questions? Okay, and in addition to having constants, we can also represent calculations. So that logic sort of thing, I can represent using C-like expressions. Our assumption is that a sort of production implementation of this hardware programming language would have something that compiles these C expressions down to a description of how to build gates that do that. Which for something like this bitwise AND is pretty simple, but we're going to allow operations where it's not so simple and assume that someone else deals with that problem, not us. So here I'm saying I have C is connected to a circuit which computes the bitwise AND of B and A, and B and A are connected to fixed values, they're hardwired to something. So it's this is a representation of this circuit. Something you might notice is that, wait, I wrote C before A and B. So remember I said that the assignment operator here represents that the input's connected to something, and it's connected or not, and the order doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter what order I wrote it in. Values are going to propagate as they would physically. So like if we have a physical circuit, the order in which things happen is based on how information goes through wires to other wires. It's not based on the order we write down how the circuit was built. So C is connected to this AND thing, and that AND thing is connected to A and B, and it doesn't matter the order we specify it in. We're going to get the same value in C, regardless. So questions? This? Yes. So the question, if wire A and B are both 2 bits, how is it holding B10? So OB represents a binary constant. So that's a 2-bit constant, 10. That is on A, and B has a 2-bit constant, 11. And, okay, does that make sense? Okay. So as I mentioned, we can have lots of C-like expressions, so we can also do, for example, addition. And this will do addition with truncation. So the extra bits that are lost, just silently. So this is representing a much more complicated circuit that does that addition, but it's the same sort of idea, that C is connected to an adder which adds A and B because it's connected to A and B with the being the inputs to the adder. Questions? Okay. So we have ways of representing values, moving around, and doing calculations on them. So let's try to build something very simple, so a counter. So we need lots of counters in our computers. Most prominent example is we have a program counter. So, you know, it's going to be something we're going to want. So here's sort of a notional simple idea of how we'd make a counter. We'd have a wire holding a value, in this case a 3-bit value, and we have something that adds 1. And I can represent this in HTLRS like so. So I have a wire X that is a 3-bit wire bundle, really. And I'm saying that the input of X is a circuit that adds 1 to X. So that's the drawing I've done. And, you know, so what we hope is that I somehow start this at like 0. And then the good question is, wait a moment, I never specified the starting value of X. How's that going to work? Good. It's a problem. But we'll ignore that for now. We'll hope it just starts at 0. And that it's going to advance, hopefully one at a time, to 1, 2, 3, and I'm writing in binary here. You know, this is some HTLRS code. If I try this, what's going to happen? I'm going to get an error. That our simulator tool is going to say, I refuse to do that. And it refuses to do that because this is not a circuit that we're going to try to build. This is not the way we're going to do this. This is something which wouldn't be stable. And the problem comes with what happens when we go from one value to another. So if we think of what's going to go on in this counter circuit, we look at the least significant bit, it's going to be alternating from 0 to 1 to 0. And what we'd imagine is that if this is represented as a voltage, it goes instantaneously from the low voltage to the high voltage. But that's not actually physically possible. In a physical realization of this, you know, we're going to have some voltages in between. That's just how it's going to have to work physically. So we'll end up with this sort of unsmooth line here. And there's one problem from this, which is that we have these in-between values, and we're going to be presenting those values to the add one circuit. And the question is, what's the add one circuit going to do? And typically the answer is, well, you know, while you're presenting that in-between value, who knows what the add one circuit will do? You know, it only is going to do something useful if you're presenting a stable 0 or 1 value. If you're in between, it does weird stuff. And, you know, people typically don't want to try to build their circuits to handle that weird in between. And what's going to make this worse is that, well, we have actually this bundle of wires. We don't just have the least significant bit. We also have, say, the second least significant bit, which is changing in a different way. And typically, the way we're going to build this adder is that it's not going to change perfectly in sync with the least significant bit. You know, just physically, that's going to be very difficult to do. There's going to be some slight desynchronization, which means that, you know, we're going to have some periods in time where, like say here, where maybe the adder will think it's getting 1-1 instead of 0-1 or 1-0 as input, which is really likely to mess it up. Just because it's going to be really hard to build this so it's really perfectly in sync. So we have this sort of in-between behavior that's going to make this very unstable. So question back there? So the question is, this is assuming the clock has an infinitesimally small period. So the problem here is that we don't have a clock. So our fix is going to be to add a clock. But here, there's nothing saying when the adder is done or not. We're just assuming we're just going to send the input back and that's going to work. So our fix that you're previewing is that we're going to add a clock somehow. But we're going to have to do a little extra work for that. Other questions? So all these transient values, these in-between values that we are going to observe from this sort of loop back are going to make this circuit unstable. It's going to be really hard to predict what happens if we try to build this, unless we're building in some really, you know, exotic ways. So this is not the sort of design we're going to use. We're going to have to do something when we design our circuits to prevent depending on these sort of transient values. So we're going to have in-between values, but we want to make sure that we don't try to use them. We want to make sure that the value that's coming into this adder is something that's stable, that it's not going to change unexpectedly when we're trying to use its result. Of course, it's going to have to change, but we want to make sure that for the most part, it doesn't change, and that when it does change, we can control that. And to make, you know, a stable input here, we basically need something that's going to store the value we're computing on while we're computing on it. So we're going to add some extra elements to store values, and those elements are going to be things like registers or memory. I'm going to start with registers, which are going to be our simplest form of this. So our solution is going to be to add a register. I'll call it count, just to give it a name. That's going to store the value we're currently adding 1 to. And it's going to keep that value stable while we're adding 1. And when we're done adding 1, we're going to actually store the new value. And we're going to have some input to this register, which is denoted by, if I was drawing a full diagram, there would be an input we call the clock signal going into this notch here. But I'm basically never going to draw that input, but that's why the register looks like this. That controls when we take in a new value. And by doing this, we'll end up with that behavior we wanted. We'll start at 0, go 1, 2, 3, and so on. And once we get to 7, we'll wrap around to 0. And this register is going to update based on this clock signal that we're going to provide it. That's we're going to set up to ensure that it only updates when the adder is done adding, when we don't have a transient value, when it's not in between. And we're going to wait to do the next update until the adder has the next value and nothing in between. So we're going to use this to avoid changing things during those in-between values. And while the adder is working, we're going to give it one stable input, which is going to be the value we're storing. Some questions about this idea of having a register? Okay, so this is our register. So let's talk about sort of our notion of register. So if you take an ECE class, you might learn that there's other types of register designs. For this class, we're going to draw our registers like this. And our registers are going to take in a clock signal, which I'm representing with this sort of square wave. This is the clock signal. This would be an input. And I'm showing sort of a graph of the voltage over time, of sort of an ideal clock signal. So we probably can't really make the clock signal go perfectly straight up and down, but it's going to be as close, approximately that. It's going to be close to that. So our clock signal is going to have this sort of periodic pattern where it goes up, waits for a bit while being high, goes down, waits for a bit being low, goes up. And the registers we're going to use for this class will update on the rising edges of that clock signal. And that means that they'll be outputting the value they're storing, which here I'm representing as just color. So we're outputting the blue value. Then that rising edge of the clock happens, and the register reads in a new value, which in this case is the green value, and starts outputting it until the next rising edge of the clock, when it reads in the value it's getting and starts outputting that value, which is the purple value. And notice that in between, the value that's being input has this sort of transition where it's probably unstable. It's changing all the time, and that doesn't matter because the register only cares what the value is when you have that rising edge of the clock. It doesn't care about those in-between values. It will just ignore them, which is what we want. So while, for example, our adder is computing things and its outputs are changing, we'll just ignore those changing outputs until we've waited long enough that it should be done. Some questions about this, how a register sort of works abstractly here. Okay. So the way our circuits are going to work is that they'll take all their inputs from things that look like registers and they'll send outputs to registers, and then they'll update every time we have this rising edge of the clock and go on to the next step, whatever that is. So we have our solution with our register. Let's look at how that's going to map to our hardware programming language. So HCLRS lets you declare registers, and this is the syntax. So we have this whole block for what we call a register bank. So in this case, I have one register that's part of this register bank, but I can declare multiple. When we're building a processor, it's going to turn out that we're often going to have reasons to want sort of multiple related registers. And I mark this register with a label for the left and right side. So the register has an input and an output, and those are going to be wires, so really wire bundles. And I'm saying that this lowercase x labels the inputs, and this uppercase y labels the outputs. The label always has to be one character, lowercase for the inputs, uppercase for the outputs. This is chosen mostly to be consistent with our textbook. And each register has a name. We use that prefix to construct the names of the input and output wires. So there's an output wire called capital Y count, which we don't assign to because that's what the register, you know, assigns to for us, is connected to. But we need to connect something to the register's input, lowercase x count, which is what we do in the statement after the register bank. And so I have the input set. And I can also supply an initial value. In this case, I say that when our machine boots, you know, the hardware should set this register up to be set to 0. And I also indicate that the register is a 3-bit register. So questions about how this register stack works? So if we have this code, if we run this sort of in simulation, what we're going to see is that initially we're going to have Y count be 0. Why is it going to be 0? Because that's the initial value of our register. So we have 0 flowing out over here, I should say 0, 0, 0, and therefore 0, 0, 0 is also the input to this adder, meaning which is represented by this expression here. So sometime in the first clock cycle, before that rising edge of the clock, just as fast as the circuit can work, the add 1 is going to output 0, 0, 1, which is our lowercase x count, the input to the register. But that input won't take effect until the first rising edge of the clock signal. So after the first rising edge of the clock signal, the register copies its input to its output, and shortly thereafter, the new output, which initially will be 001, propagates down this wire all the way over to here, and the adder adds 1 to 1 instead of 0 to 1, and computes our next value of 2. Then another rising edge of the clock happens, and our register stores that 2 from its input. It starts outputting it. So that value can propagate back to the adder, and we can calculate 3, and so on. So questions about what's going on here? Not seeing any, so let's do this exercise. So here I have a HTLRS program with 2 registers. They're initially outputting 1. And I'm asking, what's going to be the output after 2 rising edges of the clock? And I would recommend making a table for this. So who would like some more time? Okay, most people, okay. That's where we are. And if you haven't started, where I'd start is I'd start making a table. Initially, YA and YB are one. So that's part of our first, the first row of the table I would make. Okay, so who'd like more time now? Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus that F. So I guess the thing that some people that might be a bit confusing here is that we're importing XA here. And what that means is that if I look at my diagram, I have an adder which is going into the register A. The output of that adder, called XA, is also going into the adder for register B. That's what that means. And remember, I told you earlier that order doesn't matter. So this means, like, practically speaking, to figure out what's going on, well, you know, I'm thinking I'm going to have a value coming from out of here, going into this adder, and I need to figure out what happens with that adder before I can figure out what happens with this adder because of how things are wired up. Some questions about how to solve this. I'm thinking I don't need to go over much detail because it seemed like you people were comfortable with it. Yes. Can you go over solving it? Okay, so the procedure I did is I would make a table. So first of all, I know y and yb are initially one. And I figure out, okay, so what is xb? Well, xb is xa plus ya, so I don't know xa yet, so I'll figure that out first. And xa is ya plus yb. That's 1 plus 1 is 2. So I put in 2 there. Now I can figure out xb is I have 1 plus 2, so it's 3. And since these are the inputs to the registers, in the next clock cycle, they will be the outputs. So the next row of my table, after the first rising edge, I'm going to have 2, 3 coming out of those registers, and do the same procedure. XA is going to be 2 plus 3 is 5. XB is going to be 5 plus YA, which is 7, which is 2, which equals 7, I should say. And that's going to become our new YA and YB, which is how you get 5 and 7. Other questions, follow-ups? Okay. So we have registers, we know how to use them in HCLRS. So let's talk about other components that store information. So a big one we're going to have is the instruction memory. So you might say, wait a moment, don't we just have a memory? We'll get to that much later in the semester. But we're going to have a separate memory for data and instructions. And our instruction memory, we all need to read from. And the way it's going to work is it's going to be kind of like it's computing something. So we're going to input a value on this address signal, which is going to be called an HCLRS PC. That's just going to be the name of the wire. So we'll connect PC to something. And the output will be called, based on what our textbook does, I10 bytes. So it's going to be 10 bytes of instructions. You might say, wait a moment, some of our instructions aren't 10 bytes. Well, that's fine. We're just not going to use all of it. Why are we going to get 10 bytes? Well, because sometimes we need 10 bytes, so we might as well always get 10 bytes and just ignore the parts we don't use. And sort of how this we imagine this would work physically is we input a value, and with some delay, we get that 10 bytes out. When we talk about how caches work, we'll have a more realistic idea about what's going on. This is a very simplified model, which is maybe more than a bit unrealistic. But it's going to be what we're going to work with for now. So questions about the instruction memory? So there's one other piece of state we're going to need to deal with for our processor simulator, which is that we have a simulated machine, and we need a way of stopping it. And our simulator is going to have this control signal called STAT. It's just going to be the name of the wire that we configure something to. It has these values. These are just predefined constants, so it's really a 3-bit value, but we have just predefined constants for what the simulator expects. We have OK for keep going. We have halt for stop with a normal message, and some other things like INS for halt with an invalid instruction message saying that something bad happened. So you can think of this as analogous to in real hardware, you know, something that would like control the power supply. Like, we're not going to have that sort of level of sophistication, so this is our analog of that. And the reason I just mentioned the instruction memory is because our simulator, in addition to requiring this signal to know should it keep going, because it's designed assuming we're always building a processor, it's going to require us to use and always have the instruction memory, even if we don't actually do anything useful with it. So now that we have these components, we can talk about building a simple processor. So our first processor we're going to build, so we're going to execute the simplest instruction, which is nop. So what does nop do? I say, well, it does nothing, but it does increment the PC to the next instruction. And I'm going to start with a processor where, I'm going to set up the instruction memory, but I'm not going to check if the instruction's a NOP because that's the only one we implement. So I'm just going to assume it's a NOP and just advance the PC to the next byte. So this is sort of the processor we're building. We take kind of a register to hold our program counter. We hook it up to the instruction memory and ignore what the instruction memory puts out because we aren't actually checking if it's really an op. We're just assuming it's an op. And because it's an op, we're going to add one to advance to the instruction after the op, which is we're going to assume is another op. So to implement this in HTLRS, I need a register for the PC. And since our addresses are 64 bits, it's going to be a 64-bit register. I'm going to have an input and output from that. In this case, I have lowercase p for my input, uppercase capital F for my output. And I'm going to represent the adder. So I'm going to say we take the output, add one to it, and the result of that adder is going to be connected to the input to the register. And I'm also going to connect the output of the register to the signal that goes into our instruction memory, which is hardwired with the name PC. So I retrieve that instruction and ignore it. And in addition, I'm going to tell the simulator, hey, keep going. Because I just got a NOP. Well, I think it's a NOP. I didn't actually check. But it's probably not. So questions about our NOP processor? So we have this simple processor. And to use it, well, our simulator, as soon as we're running a processor and it has that instruction memory, so you need to provide it something to load that instruction memory. So what we can do is we can take, say, a simple assembly program. Here's my simple assembly program, 5 NOPs. And I can convert it into an executable, which is one of those .yo files. And then I can use the HTLRS program to run it. So sort of an example of what that would look like is that if I have my HCL code in notcpu.hcl and the .yo file I built earlier, would run it like this. And it would run, notice it produced, there's lots of output I'm not showing here, because it would say timed out after 9,998 cycles. Why did it time out? Well, by default, the simulator doesn't go on forever. It actually stops after a maximum number of cycles. And I'd say, why did it keep going? We only wrote 5 NOPs. Remember, we didn't check if it was a NOP. We just assumed. So it doesn't matter that it's not really a NOP. So we got... So let's do the live demo. So wrong directory. So this is what it really looks like when we run it. So I omitted some lines on the slide for some reason. But if we like limit this to a few instructions, which we can do. So if I limit it to 5, we could see what it looks like here. So we see we have, our first cycle. It tells us a bunch of other values. So we have a register file. So there's a built-in storage for registers. Why is it built in? Mainly so we can easily debug things and figure out if your processor is correct. We also have output showing us the value of that register I defined. So initially it's 0. During the next cycle, it's 1, and so on. And I also have the values of memory. So you might say, wait a moment, so this means there's no memory after address 4? Yes, there is. The default value of memory is 0 if we didn't load something into it. So everything that's not shown is zeros. And also we have this output which shows us what we supplied to the instruction memory. So in the first cycle, we supplied a PC of 0, so we loaded the NOP. In the second cycle, we supplied a PC of 1, so we loaded the NOP. You might notice that this doesn't mean we interpreted anything as an op. It just means that this is telling you for debugging, you should have interpreted it as an op. In particular, if I go, beyond our string of ops, we look, okay, in our ninth cycle, we set the PC to 9, and we loaded the instruction here, which was 0, 0, which is a halt. Why didn't we halt? Well, because we didn't implement halt. It's just telling us we loaded the halt because that's what we should have done. Some questions on sort of this simple HTLRS output? Yeah. The question, why does it say halt here? Because the contents of memory say that's a halt instruction. So if we go to our table of Y86 machine code, we'd say, oh, it's the halt line. So it's doing that decoding work for us. So we can also, it turns out, get the raw values that were there and have you decode it yourself. But as a convenience, the HTLRS will decode it for you to help you debug your processor. Other questions? So the question is, where is the register we define exist in the hardware? So in a hardware implementation, there are going to be registers that represent both, typically the registers that you see in assembly, and there will be other registers for internal use of the hardware. Okay. And I would say that the reason why the things we use in assembly that are called registers are called registers is because usually they're implemented with registers, but that's not required. We could, for example, use memory to implement those registers. That probably wouldn't make much sense from a performance point of view, but it's perfectly valid microarchitecture, which would still implement the same instruction set. Other questions? So we saw our bug lines are not a CPU. So we saw that, we fetched some halt instructions. I didn't actually write the halt instructions, but just because memory defaulted to 0, I ended up with halt, so that's really convenient. But now we want to actually make a decision based on that. That we weren't very happy that when we got over here, we were fetching halts, but we were interpreting them as nops. Well, because there's no code in here to do anything else. There's no code to make a decision. So we're going to need some mechanism to make a decision with our processor. And so we're going to have some hardware tool to sort of do the equivalent of an if-else. And the basic hardware tool we're going to use for that is something we'll call a multiplexer. So sort of the hardware structure is that we have this thing which takes in some number of inputs. Here I'm showing 4, but it could be more or less. So my 4 inputs are A, B, C, and D, and also a selection input. And the idea is that the selection input tells us which of these inputs to use. So if the selection input is 0, we'll output A. If the selection input is 1, we'll output B, and so on. And we can build this multiplexer using gates. So I could have given you a bit puzzle-like problem, which is to make a multiplexer. Harder people in the DC course will know how to efficiently build it in hardware from things like AND gates. We're basically not going to worry about that. We're going to really abstract this multiplexer. So you might say, oh, so that means you're going to give me some operator in HTLRS, which represents this thing. No, we're going to go even more abstract than that, because if I gave you this, then you have to construct a circuit which sets a value to 0, 1, or 2, which you could do, You know, think of it as sort of a bit puzzle-like problem. But it turns out this is something that, well, software is pretty good at, and we're going to just kind of assume that we're going to be able to give software, you know, some expressions about, you know, if this is true, I want to select this value, and that it can translate that into some circuitry that makes a 0, 1, or 2, or 3, or whatever, based on what value you want to use, and something that hooks up the values to our multiplexer input. So we're going to have this really abstract thing to represent our multiplexers that we'll see in a bit. But this multiplexer, it really is just like a funny logic gate. We can like write a truth table for it, and it looks very much like, you know, sort of truth tables for traditional gates, just with maybe a few more inputs. And it, our textbook actually alludes to sort of a common way of building these out of gates. But what we're actually going to use is what our book calls a case expression. So this is going to be what, in our hardware programming language, is going to represent a multiplexer. So there's a lot of steps here to turn this into actually using a multiplexer. So the way this case expression is going to work is that it's going to be evaluated as if in order. So in this case, our result is going to be, if x equals 5 is true, it's going to be 1. If x is in the set 0 or 6, so if x is 0 or x is 6, it's going to be 2. If x is greater than 2, it's going to be 3. Otherwise, if 1 is true, which it always is, it's going to be 4. Notice that we have this default case here, this sort of always true value that is required in HTLRS. You cannot omit it. So in this example, if x is 5, yes, 5 is greater than 2, but we check the first thing first. You might say, how is this going to work in the hardware? So in the hardware, something is going to need to look at this and make a circuit, which basically is going to output a select signal of 0 for an input of 5, a select signal of 1 for an input of 0 or 6, a select signal of 2 for an input that's greater than 2, and a select signal of 3 otherwise. They're going to build like a fancy bitwise operator tree that does that. We're not going to worry in this class about the details of doing that sort of thing. That's a topic for an ECE class. We're just going to assume that's done for us, because that's not really the sort of thing we want to spend more time on. So we're going to have this very high-level abstraction, which we're going to really hope can be turned into efficient hardware in a pretty automated manner, or at worst, we can dump it onto someone who specializes in that, and they can make it turn into efficient hardware for us. Yes? Why is x equals 0 not on the table on the bottom? Just because I didn't put it there. So someone tell me, what if x was 0, what would the result be? Yeah.
2.
Yes, because it's in the set 0, 6. And what else did I make? And how about if x equals 2? What would the result be? Sorry.
4.
Yes. It doesn't match any of the cases, and 1 is always true. This is not x equals 1. This is 1. A value that is true. Yes.
Is 0, 6 not a range, right?
Question 0, 6 is not a range? Yes, so it is a set of values. If you want to do a range, you should do like x greater than and less than. Yes?
It's true, false, 0, 1. This version where it's just false, 0.
So the question is true or false, 0, 1, unlike C? No, it is like C. So 0 is false, everything else is true. I just chose 1 for my true value instead of something else. Other questions? Okay, since we've seen muxes, we can do this. So if bar is 9, what's foo? Yeah? 200. So 9 is not greater than 10. Yes, 9 is less than 20, but we don't get there yet. We evaluate these cases in order. And 9 ended with 1. Well, the least significant bit of 9 is 1. So that's going to be 1, which is equal to 1. So we're going to output 200 as Pooh's value. How about if bar is 10? Yeah? 300. So if bar is 10, it's not greater than 10. The least significant bit is not 1, but it is less than 200, so we get 300. And if bar is 11, we would hit the first case, 100, because 11 is greater than 10, even though it's true that the least significant bit of 11 is 1. Okay. So we're comfortable with muxes, so let's use them. Now let's build a CPU that does something slightly more interesting. We're going to implement two instructions. We're going to implement nop, which remember is encoded 1-0, and halt, which is encoded 0-0. And we're going to use that mux, which is going to be written as a case expression, to take the opcode and decide what to do. So what's that going to look like? So we're going to have the same logic we had before for incrementing the PC, because these instructions are 1 byte. But we're going to take the output of the instruction memory and actually use it. So we're going to have to somehow get the opcode, and then we're going to use that to decide between a status of keep going or halt, or I'm going to have this third option of halt telling the user there was an invalid instruction. So we basically know what this mux is going to look like, but the extract opcode part we actually haven't gone through yet. And to do this extract opcode part, well, we have this output of the instruction memory, which I told you was i10 bytes. It's a 10-byte value. So what does that mean? Well, it's going to be a 10-byte number. So let's say this is our instruction memory here. So we have at each address, each byte, we have a single value, but we get 10 bytes out of that. You might say, well, what format do those 10 bytes come in? Well, all our values and wires in HTLRS, we think of as numbers. So it's a 10-byte number, and we always use little endian, so we got it from memory in little endian format. So if we put in a PC of 0, we get the first 10 bytes here as a little endian number. Little endian means that the least significant byte is of that number is the lowest address, which notably is where our opcode's going to be. So the most significant 4 bits of that least significant byte, that's where our opcode's going to be. You might also notice that we got a few extra bytes, more than a few extra bytes, for our instruction. So if this was a nop or halt, we have 9 extra bytes. In this case, if you remember our coding table, this is an add instruction, so we have 8 extra bytes. That's fine, as long as we don't use them, and we're not going to. But why are we retrieving 10 bytes? Because, well, eventually we're going to have some instructions where we use all 10 bytes. And the second byte of the instruction, the byte at the address plus 1, that's going to be the second least significant byte of that number. So now that we know how it's represented as a number, like how do we extract that to like make use of it? So in HTLRS, we have an operator that kind of looks like array indexing for taking a wire bundle, a wire, and taking some bits of it. So this syntax is start dot dot end. It's inclusive of the start, exclusive of the end. It extracts a set of bits. So you might say, how do we number bits? And our choice is the least significant bit is bit 0. And this I'm going to try to explain carefully because this is a common point of confusion. So let's say, for example, we have a push instruction. So push, if we looked it up on the table we saw before, is encoded as a byte AF, or sorry, A0 or AF. It's A0. Wow, I got this. Had this wrong the whole time. Okay. That is something to fix later. But let's say it's encoded as, for now, so it's really A0, but let's say it's AF just to be, make less edits to this slide. So if it was encoded like that, we'd have our value in memory at its address plus 0 would be AF. Our value in memory at its address plus 1 would be 2F for iteration number 2. And at x plus 2 would be the start of the next instruction. When we get our instruction memory output, the least significant 8 bits are that last byte. So bit 0 is not the opcode. Bit 4, 5, 6, 7 are the opcode. And that's what we're going to want to check to figure out what type of instruction we have. If we want to extract the register numbers, those are going to be bits 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Questions? Yeah. Question, the opcode will always be... The output is little endian. This is interpreting it as a little endian number. So I think what causes confusion is our table is written with the least significant, the first byte of the the byte with the lowest address on the left. And when we write a number down in English, we write that part of the number on the right. And that's what causes so much confusion. So our first byte, bits 0 through 7, is this part of the table. The least significant part of that is there, because we're still writing it as like hex numbers together in English order. The most significant part of it, bits 4 through 8, are there. So our opcode is bits 4 through 8, 4 inclusive, 8 exclusive. And if we think about, say, RA, that's bits 12 through 16, not 8 through 12. And RB is bits 8 through 12. So as I said, this is a very common point of confusion. And it just has to do with sort of this disagreement between how we write numbers in English and how this table is formatted. So maybe it would have been better for the table to be formatted like this. So it's the same table, I just drew it differently. But this corresponds maybe more naturally to how we're going to read out the numbers, read out the instructions as numbers. But it's a little less naturally used for like manually encoding or decoding instructions. But we have our first byte is bit 0 through 7. Bit 0 through 4 are secondary opcode, like the condition code stuff. Bits 4 through 8 are the opcode. Some questions about how we select what bits to use? Yes?
We're writing the machine code.
Question is, when we're writing our machine code, we should be rewriting all our instructions out in a little endian form. So the way we've defined our machine code here is I've said the byte at address plus 0 is this one, the byte at address plus 1 is this one, and so on. So that's not dependent on endianness, right? We don't have to like tell, I'm not like asking you to write a number down and then I have to figure out how that number maps to addresses. I'm telling you explicitly this part of the instructions at this address. So there's no endianness problem. Does that answer your question? And I guess I should say also, like when we looked at our instruction examples, I like gave you a list of bytes and sort of my promise was, you know, it was a list where the leftmost one was the lowest address, then the second lowest address, and so on. That's generally what we expect when we see a list of bytes, right? That I didn't like write it in opposite address order. I probably would be very explicit if I was doing that. Okay. Other questions? Yes. Sorry? So we think the opcode are these blue boxes here. I call them the opcode because they determine, they're the primary thing that determines what operation we're doing. I guess I should be a little careful because it's legitimate to call the CC and FN fields like secondary opcodes because they're like also help determine what operation we're doing. And sometimes you'll see people say like the whole, therefore that whole whole byte is the opcode rather than just the 4 bits. But I will try to refer to these 4 bits as the opcode and the, and if there's another 4 bits, that is the secondary opcode. But you might see people referring to instruction sets that look like Y86 saying like the whole thing's the opcode or something like that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so now we know how to extract our opcode field. So let's use that. So I have my mux and I have my case expression where I take i10 bytes, bits 4 through 8, which we determined was that opcode field. And I have this comparing to nop or holt. You might say, how is this? So these are built-in constants. I could have also written their actual values directly if I wanted to. But we have built-in constants, so you don't need to remember the encoding all the time, or look up the encoding all the time, hopefully. And also, so you can make it so you can maybe kind of read your code. So questions? Yes. So the question is, why is the invalid instruction the default case? So the behavior I'm getting here, and I guess I can, I could actually show this. That's not the right place. Is that if I have this CPU here, I can hopefully run the CPU. If I run it on nops, it's going to say it halted because it fetched a halt instruction. But let's say I have something where I have some other instruction, like here. So the second instruction is a jump. So that's going to hit that default case. And what telling the simulator this status is going to do is it's going to make it stop, but it's going to make it stop in a different way. So I can do so, and it says we had an error causing the state telling us why it stopped. So that's the only difference between the two. So like we probably have a more complicated mechanism to do the same kind of thing in real hardware. But basically this is a simple mechanism of signaling errors to the user. You know, as we'll learn later in the semester, sort of the most closely equivalent thing in real hardware is something which like tells the OS about something like things like seg faults. Like, this is our closest analogy to that. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So, given where the other lecture is, I probably shouldn't go too much further. So our preview is, so we have nop and halt, and we're basically going to keep applying this, adding this muxes to make decision principle. So the next decision we're going to make is we're going to take this and we're going to try to add jump. So what's that going to mean? Well, that means that the next instruction we fetch here, that's going to be a mux. Right, instead of being always plus one, sometimes we want to jump somewhere. So that's going to be our step. And then sort of our next few remaining steps are going to be that we're going to need to go from that to adding, well, we need registers that the assembly programmer has. So we're going to have to add those. And we're also going to need some way of like having instructions that access memory. And we can't do that right now because, well, the instruction memory has one input to fetch the instruction. We can't simultaneously or be fetching something else. So we're going to add some components to do that, to handle like reading and writing from memory. So that's what we'll get to next week. And I think I'll finish up here because, yeah, we're definitely maybe a little bit ahead of the other lecture.